Okay, we're in the middle, you know, still towards the beginning of Shabtai Tzvi's life. He is still in Izmir, still in Smyrna, Izmir. We have already seen his first significant, you know, historical deviation slash pattern of saying Shem Hashem Kiksivasa.
Is it like actually saying Yud Kivavke?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, that was his first known deviation. It's all around.
Is that his tefillah?
He apparently said, you know, when people try to write, you know, popular stories about it, this is a history, this is a dry history book. Okay? He doesn't try to flesh much out. I mean, when something's brought in an accurate source, accurate early source, so he'll discuss it. But he doesn't attempt to flesh that much out. But if you read a more populist version of it, they usually talk about Shabtai Tzvi doing this when called to the Torah. Now, I don't know. In other words, he obviously, if he did it privately, then no one would know about it, and people knew about it. So when do you say a bracha probably?
When
you call to the Torah. I mean, it could be there's other cases, you know, you say a bracha, there's a din l'chamchil to say a bracha out loud, but it's not really public usually. Usually the public time, a person says a bracha publicly is when they're called to the Torah. There's a certain logic to that, yeah.
Isn't there a problem with that because we don't even know specifically how to say it?
There's a problem with it. There's a definite problem with that. It's definitely an Isser. Shabtai Tzvi, the reason why he did it, as mentioned the last time we said this year, is he thought he was Mashiach. Be'ikvus Takvata, his reaction was, I'm Mashiach.
Very humble person.
Well, I also mentioned the last time, you know, the Rambam in Geros Taimon says, you know, person anyone who claims you're Mashiach is probably crazy.
Yeah, so if he's...
So we're going to get there. So the question everyone asked, and guys asked me that the last time, and we've been asked before, is how in the world did he convince people he's Mashiach?
No, I have another question.
Yeah, which is?
If you're legally crazy, like you're actually insane, how much are you held up, like, in, like, Shemayim? Like, is that how much are you...
That's a good question. Okay. How much are you held responsible for your actions if you're totally crazy? That's a good question. That's a hard question to answer straight. I don't think there's a straight, easy answer to it. I mean, that gets down to one of the most important fundamentals in the Jewish religion, which is Bechira, free will. I don't know. Was there a point where he could have done something to himself to maintain his sanity? That's a hard question to answer. L'chaim, there should be, in theory. Hashkafa, in theory, says there should be. Could be there wasn't, I don't know, it's a hard question to answer straight. As also mentioned, Shabtai Tzvi was what today is called bipolar, and used to be called manic depressant. That means sometimes he was manic, and sometimes he was depressant, sometimes he was normal. We spoke about all these things before. But it was mentioned last time also, just to go back over it, in case we forgot, is Shabtai Tzvi's, you know, wild actions, is... strange actions like saying Shem Hashem and other ones. We saw another one already. Did we see that one?
Did we have to deal with his wives?
No, we're not going to get there. I think we'll get there next. We had his two wives. We had two of his first two wives. We got rid of, like...
First time.
Yeah, that's a long, old story. His third, very interesting wife, we based her Shem. I think we'll get to her next week, but if not, the week afterwards. We should get to her. She's a very interesting character.
She's the third or fourth?
She's the third. She definitely had four, and it could be there's even a fifth, but I'm not sure.
Nothing good. She's good anymore.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, that's not, trust me, that's not the most controversial part of Shabtai Tzvi. His wives are not the most controversial. I mean, the first two are, whatever, sort of controversial. But okay. Now we're going on to, as we mentioned, Shabtai Tzvi was from Izmir / Smyrna, and he was forced in some time between 1651 and 1653 to leave, and the question is why? Why was he forced to leave Smyrna? He has already been claiming his Mashiach since 1648. whether it was in summer 48 or fall 48 or whenever with Snafkamina, you know, okay, historically we could debate, but he clearly was in Izmir for a good 2 years after his claims of Mashiach. He also has been saying Shem Hashem whenever he's given a bracha to the Torah, and maybe some other times also, but again, it just won't be as public. He's been saying Shem Hashem for 2 years already. So this is not enough. Lachara, why should he be thrown out? In other words, he's been showing some funny acts. He's a character.
He's a Mikubar, right?
He was sort of, yeah, he was. He definitely delved into Kabbalah. Certainly, it was, it's a known fact that Kabbalah has a certain danger to it. Four people, Nichnasu with Pardes. It's dangerous.
Wait, that's talking about Kabbalah?
Yes, it is.
And, oh, okay.
Yes, it is. Arba Nechusul Pardes is speaking about Kabbalah, and there is a certain danger in Kabbalah. And that's why, as the Rambam says, and as far as we know, the Rambam did not know Kabbalah. And I spoke about that last year at great length. But if you want me to give you a quick synopsis, I'd do it over dinner. As the Rambam says, it's not for everybody. And there's a story in Shas about one person who messed with Kabbalah, one who messed with Rishis. He said, teach me this, teach me that, you teach me this, I'll teach you that. Okay, they taught him, he refused to teach them. I don't know who which one knew which. But as the Rambam says, it wasn't because he was a bad person, rather, it was because everyone's not, he was able to see from what they thought they understood, my celebrations from my Kabbalah, whatever they thought they really understood, they didn't really understand it. And he is able to see, he's not supposed to give it on over to them. So Kabbalah is a known dangerous thing, and let's go on a little and see where we have this getting. We have this mystery, Shabbat, so he's thrown out of his hometown, his family are not poor people, they're not the richest people in town, but they're not poor people. They're well connected. So he had to be thrown out for something significant. So the question is what? So there's only one known story. This is an example of there's only one known story. The story is you have to realize that Shabtai Tzvi before 1665 was just another Meshuggah who claimed to be Mashiach. Okay, every Jewish city, as Chaim Shapiro says, every Jewish city was supposed to have a Rav and was supposed to have a Shechet. It's supposed to have a chasm. But you could get by temporarily without one of those. But without a meshugana, it wasn't possible. You couldn't have a shtetl without one local meshugana. Okay? That's facts of life. You know, every year there is always, today we take the crazy people and we put them in insane asylums and we drug them and do all sorts of things to them. We control people who are not so stable. We have ways to control them. Back in the old days, they didn't. And as long as the person wasn't killing people, or attempting to kill people, so he got to walk around and say his crazy things all to whoever he wanted. So okay, so you have a guy who's somewhat crazy. And there's a couple of crazy people in the town. So what's he being thrown out for? Okay, so the story goes like this. Shabtai Tzvi gathers some friends together, friends/Talmidim. It's not clear if he really had Talmidim, but whatever, he gathers friends together, and he decides... He's going to stop the sun, like Yeshua did. And he gets together and they're saying their Kabbalistic stuff, and they're telling the sun to stop! Stop, sun! Stop! And even Gershon Chom brings the story. And they're not successful. And word gets of this escapade to the realm of the city of Yosef Iskafa. Says, this guy is nuts. And not only is he crazy, he's, influencing people. So we gotta get him. He's time to say goodbye, Shabtai Tzvi. And because of this famous story, puts Shabtai Tzvi in Chayim. And he's supposed to leave the city. Now, when Shabtai Tzvi gets to the Chayim, he says back, Katoni Avav Mimasnav. He says, my little finger is bigger than your legs, which is a Tanakhic quote from Rehoboam, when after Shlomo died, the people came to his son Rehoboam and asked him to lower taxes. So he wasn't sure what to do. So what should he do? So he asked his friends. His friends said back, tell them that your little finger is thicker than your father's wax. If your father did X, you know, your father put this amount of taxes on him, you're going to put even more. Okay, like, whatever. Anyway, that's where that phrase comes from. Anyway, Bekitzer, he's... I mean, that's sort of, look, that's in character line with Shabbat Tzvi. After all, he thought he was Mashiach. And so the Rav of the city told him not to, you know, put him in the harem for doing something. He said, I'm not bigger than you, Mashiach, who are you? So, but anyway, he was thrown out of the city. There are those who claim that Rabbi Yosef Iskafa thought maybe they should kill Shabbat Tzvi. I'm not convinced at all. I'm very unconvinced. There are those who say that. The Rabbanim of Izmir at this point thought they should kill Shabbat Tzvi because he's a future danger. I don't think so.
How many documented accounts are
there? A lot. A relative. Okay, it's like this. One of the basics. There's again. This I spoke about a couple of weeks ago. But it's important to this. There's pro Shabbat Tzvi and anti Shabbat Tzvi documents. Then there's non-Jewish observers. Non-Jewish observers have a problem that they don't always get all the facts right, but they do get a certain amount. There's certain historical, you know, validity in these non-Jewish observers. So those are the three types of documents. One of the main documents is Novel Tzitzas Tzvi. Unbelievable. Is the withering flower of Tzvi. That's a Tanakhic pun. That's written by Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortas, who was the prime public anti-Sabbatean out there. Now, as mentioned, Gershon Shalom has an axe to grind with him, and Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortas is definitely. And there's no question that he wants to paint a sort of idyllic picture, in a certain sense. And there's certain places where I definitely agree that you need certain revisionism at looking exactly what happened. There's also something called by something Francis, by something, I can't remember the first guy's name, is Yixtel Francis, Yaakov Francis, Baisha Francis, called Sri Mudach. He's another big anti-Sabbatean, of course, is Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who has, I think it's called Torah Sakanos. That's not Mamish contemporary, but it's close enough. You understand, Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote his book in the 1720s, 1730s, which is not that long afterwards. Okay, it's not, but it's not that long afterwards. And then there's Sabbatean stuff, there's Christian stuff. So there's a decent amount of documentation. The problem is earlier in his life, again, people, there's another Meshuggah walking around Smyrna claiming he's Mashiach, Shvayach. Smyrna was a relatively large city, Jewish-wise, a couple thousand Jews. It could be not one, it could be 5 or 10 people who think there's Mashiach in Smyrna. Okay. Yeah, okay, fine. Now, there is, Gershon Shalom does bring certain source material which seems to indicate that Shabbat Tzvi was engaging in what's called Kabbalah Maisis, practical Kabbalah. I suppose we spoke about Kabbalah Maisis?
Yeah.
Okay. There is certain evidence he was engaging in that. Practical Kabbalah is dangerous. It's a very well-known fact. And if Shabbat Tzvi was using it, though, at this point in his life, then that definitely, the facts are, is there's people out there, just like there were, I mean, probably more than today, but I'm not sure about that. There's people today always interested in Kabbalah Mises. You know, supposed Kabbalists, mystics, can do all sorts of funny things. You know, they always have a following. They never came to Philadelphia, no? A Kabbalist never came and said, offered to tell you all sorts of things. Okay, maybe not. Okay. Mm-hmm. These guys wonder, even today you find people who do things like this. And back in the old days it was even more common. And if he was using practical Kabbalah in a public fashion, and that is part of what's going on also, then we also better understand why they at this point in time decided to chuck him out. Because again, his unstable character has been well known for some time. Okay, he goes on to Salonika. It's unclear if he went on his own or not. Did he have a servant? There's a guy who claimed he was a servant for 13 years, but there's a lot of, Gershon Shalom has a lot of questions on it. doubting like much of what he says. Even so, it's relatively clear that at least at this point in his life, his family was supportive. I mean, they probably, I don't know, supportive. I don't know if they're supportive of his messianic claims, but if your brother's sick, unfortunately, and crazy or half crazy or whatever it is, or occasionally crazy, so you feel bad for him and you help him out. What are you supposed to do? That's what brothers are for, right? So there is very strong proof. What?
To be crazy?
No. To help their brothers out, even if they're, you know, even if they suspect their brother. That's right. Was he the youngest? It's not clear where he fell in this family. But either way, his brothers were most likely helping him out. There's a lot of, you know, different variant proof that he had money with him, and he could have afforded a servant if he wanted one. Anyway, he leaves and goes on to Salonika. Okay, so he goes into Salonika. Salonika at this point, Salonika was a larger city in terms of population, quality, qualitatively and quantitatively than Smyrna.
Wouldn't his harem push over into there?
Would the harem push over? No, not necessarily. It depends. Someone would have to be a major threat for the Rabbanim of one city to go send messages out to other cities. Watch out for this guy, he's very dangerous. And that's the proof. In other words, you said some people claim that Shabbat Tzvi, that the Rabbanim in Smyrna thought of killing him in the early 1650s. I'd say if they were that worried about it, they would have sent letters out to all the other local places. Watch out for this guy. He's very crazy. He's very dangerous. And that, the fact that they didn't was good, what I consider good circumstantial evidence that they didn't. They consider him crazy, but you'll figure it out yourselves, you know. And that's what happened. He went to Smyrna. he went to Salonika, I mean. And as mentioned, Rabbi David's, you know, family is originally from Salonika. And initially, he was a competent Talmud Chacham. He knew Nikola. He knew Nistar. And until he went manic, he was fine. And he had, you know, he wasn't poor, and he had, you know, he had good public relations. And he came in, and everyone was kind of, you know, okay. New Rav came into town. Fine, let's see who this guy is. He seems okay. He seems fine. He had a nice personality. He's, you know, he knew how to get along with people. And he doesn't have. And initially, he doesn't have a problem. But then he goes manic. When Shabbat Tzvi goes manic, he says Shem Hashem. He says, Shem Hashem, you know, Tiksiv Asa. Now, again, this is a instability, but it's going to say, okay, Nebuch. So he's unstable. Maybe he started whispering, he thinks he's, the reason why he's saying Shem Hashem, Tiksiv Asa, as mentioned 3 weeks ago, is he thought that's a sign of him being Mashiach, of you know, the times of Mashiach, to be allowed to do such a thing. And Ki'ilu, I don't know the proof for, I don't know exactly how he thought of it, but whatever, a result of him being Mashiach, he's crazy at the end of the day. The result of him being Mashiach is he can say Shem Hashem. Fine, but that's not what he does. He does something even stranger. He calls everyone together, and this is one of his famous strange acts. He calls people together, he calls, you know, Chashuv Ya'ir, a lot of important people together. Tells them he's making a big party. And again, I've seen people who've, you know, what's the right word? Popularized, novelized this as like a whole, make a whole, you know, thing out of it. And if this is his famous strange act, he calls them together and he marries a Sefer Torah.
What does that mean?
That means he puts a chuppah up, he walks in with a Sefer Torah, and he says all the brachas that you say to a kava that you say to a normal.
What do you have? Did he walk around the Sefer Torah 7 times, or did he have the Sefer Torah walk around him 7 times?
Okay, Ekman, you understand? I'm a Siddur of Frankish Kinkashas. Should I should translate that? Hasidic stories, we don't ask questions. And this is definitely well past a Hasidic story. I don't know, yeah, ask a good question. There's actually going to go on to the next, we're definitely going to get at least one or two more episodes on tonight. And I actually have a good joke from Wilmer to tell you after we get to the next episode.
I'm just wondering who's the chassan, who's the kala.
He's the chassan, and the Sefer Torah is the kala.
Okay.
So l'chara, he had to have the Sefer Torah go around him 7 times.
Okay, there's all this Kabbalah. You can make it happen, right? should have said they're part of his friends.
I don't know. Now this story is like the early Shabbatai Tzvi stuff. It's not as clear as what happens once we get to 1665 and he meets Nussan, he meets Nathan. Then things get a lot clearer. But the story, even though it's only brought in one source, it's confirmed from a lot. Shabbatai Tzvi wrote, signed his name in letters more than once. The Baal, the husband of Sefer Torah, of the Torah, and he would call the Torah a beautiful woman, etc., etc., etc. Chazan Hayotze Michidra Mechedra. Yeah, okay, fine. So he was strange.
Really?
And, that's right. And the Rebbetzin of Salonika, he was did not stay in Salonika about a year until he was forced because of this to leave. It's not quite as radical as what he did earlier in Izmir, but I guess, in Izmir he had local contacts. And we're going to go on Bezer Hashem to Constantinople. He's going to do some really radical stuff over there. But this is not as radical, but he didn't have as much, apparently local backing. So he's thrown out of Salonika and wanders around for a couple of years. Let's say it has to at least be 3 years, but it could be as much as 5 years. He ends up in Constantinople in around 1658. Now, he was in Constantinople for less than a year. Constantinople, we happen to forget, is the capital of the Turkish Empire. The Jewish community there is strong. It's not quite as qualitatively strong as Salonika. Salonika had more rabbanim and yeshivas, but it was strong, it was large, it was well-to-do, and they were more nervous about crazy people in Constantinople than they were in Salonika or Izmir, because they were sitting in the capital, and the Turks, let's brief off, Turkish law up until a certain point was when one sultan died, and then the next one was whoever took over killed all other heirs to the throne.
Classy Muslims.
later they changed it and they locked them up, in like sort of a semi-prison, but. I mean, you understand that it's not only a monarchy, totalitarian monarchy, it's also they're very nervous about any type of threat. So the Jewish community in Constantinople is a little more nervous than other places. Anyway, he gets to Constantinople. And again, it's a similar idea. He comes in, he knows, he's going to be, when he was not manic, when he was normal or depressed, he was fine. He knew something. I mean, he wasn't. I'm not thoroughly convinced that Gershon Scholem's statement that he wasn't a deep thinker is absolutely true. But whatever. But he was competent. Competency no one takes away from him, and he was able to make a good impression on people. He had good public relations, and he's again in Constantinople. Everything starts out fine. Until he goes manic. When he goes manic, he has a problem.
How long are these periods of time?
We don't know. That was stated that we don't know. The manic states appear to be for no more than a couple of weeks. Maybe could range up to 2 or 3 months, but not more than that.
Like, wouldn't he realize that something was really wrong and he just snapped out of the manic state?
He was very... Okay. This is before psychology existed, well before. The reason we're sure that he had these manic bouts is because they're described enough places, but again, by opponents and by proponents and by neutral observers, they're very cyclically described, and it very strongly fits into descriptions of what today we consider manic depressants / people who are bipolar. We're of course not 100% sure because the patient has been dead, Baruch Hashem, for a long time. Okay, anyway, so in Constantinople, He goes manic. Was this his first manic attack or not? We're not sure, but he goes manic. When he goes manic, he buys a large fish.
I'm sensing a theme.
Yeah, this is going to sound good.
Dresses it up as a baby.
Oh, no.
And puts it in a cradle.
Why? What?
I mean, he had Kabbalistic reasons for it.
Did he in the Torah have a child?
Okay, heck, but that wasn't bad. So Rimmer said differently. Rimmer said, of course he had to do this, because after all, he was married to the Torah, so he had to adopt. Okay, you know, that's what we say, call it Sinusasur, Chutzmisinusdevonazar. We certainly make fun of Shabbat Zvi and Mitzvah. It's definitely a Mitzvah. Okay, so this is strange. This is strange.
I didn't get that impression at all.
But now we're coming on now to some very important information which I want to go through in a clear fashion. So you'll understand if you ever you're exposed to this anywhere else, or just for the record, you'll understand how it exactly works. He's thrown out of Constantinople. Now again, they are nervous people in Constantinople. Okay, that we know. That we explain that. And this is strange. It's luchara less halach. I mean, the guy's just unstable. Now I'm sure there are other unstable Jews walking around in Constantinople. Again, you could have a city, you could temporarily not have the Rav, the Dayan, the judge, the Chazonim, so they're not there, they go on vacation, but you have to have your Mishugoyim. So, they had some crazy Jews walking around Constantinople. And if the guy just dresses up fish, puts them in cradles, and says they have mystical symbolisms, fine, the guy's Nabuch. You're not going to throw the guy out. He's not only thrown out, he's probably beaten and imprisoned. Probably. What did he do?
What about the child?
What do you mean? Good question. They ate it in Shoshanis. Okay. What did
he
do? I don't know. It's a large fish. Herring or small fish?
Herring
or small fish, and this is the Middle East. It's not. Okay, whatever. Anyway. Okay. What did he do? He must have done something really radical in order to get such severe reaction. And we're now, it's not, again, this is before he's really famous or infamous, so people don't know as much about him yet. And we're sort of, it's a combination of fishing, ki'ilu, and, you know, interpolating out of known facts. One of the reports says that the Rabbanim in Constantinople were worried about, quotes, a new sect, a new religion. And again, that's vague. Like, what in the world? You know, like, again, I mean, I don't think, you know, dressing a fish up as a baby
in a carrot. Fish.
And it doesn't seem to me and you to be that attractive. So what did he do? What did he do? Okay. Now we're going to go now diverge briefly. There is something, a very famous Sabbatean forgery, called Machaze de Rabbi Avram, or the vision of Rabbi Abraham. We're not going to tell you when this is going to be discovered. This is going to be discovered at a very dramatic point in the story. It's definitely not going to be next week, maybe the week afterwards, maybe in 3 weeks. After, he's going to have to meet his wife first. He first meets his wife, it could be the week after. It's probably not be that year, it might be the week after that year. A very dramatic point in Shabtai Tzvi's life is the discovery of this Machzor de Rabbi Avram. That is, it's a very important thing. It was almost certainly forged by Nosson, by Nathan of Gaza. It's impossible based on, it's just impossible. There's too many, there's a lot of biographical facts there, which Shabtai Tzvi apparently told Nathan. Apparently. And as a result, it has a lot of very important historical information in it. Okay, so what does it say there? It says in Matzah, it says in a Tosefos, and in addition to it, which is found in a couple of places, that in 1658, the Mashiach, in other words, Shabtai Tzvi, is going to celebrate all three Yom Tovim in 1 week. Isn't water atone for the Jews who did not properly celebrate Yom Tov throughout all of history? We're not done. Hashem will give them a new law and commandment.
He's kind of a fun guy.
He's right, said to Isaac. 3 weeks ago, he's right, Isaac. We're not done. And he will make the bracha Matir Asurim. Okay.
What?
Okay. This is Shabtai Tzvi's. This is the beginning of one of the most famous or infamous acts of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi Ki'ilu would pick up a ham sandwich, say, Boruch Ato Hashem, Elokeinu Ma'al Cholom, Matir Asurim. Swallow the stuff. Okay. These are very, very famous set, both style things. In other words, that was Shabtai Tzvi celebrating 3 Yom Tov, 2 or 3. At the wrong time. We saw that once already. In other words, last time we saw Shabtai Tzvi almost drowned, and then he was saved, and he decided it's like Purim. And the day before, it was like time disaster. Okay? This is stereotypical Shabtai Tzvi. And as I said last year, which again was 3 weeks ago, is Shabtai Tzvi has a certain nuance to him that he's not part of Torah, but he's based on Torah. He's not just Reformed Judaism, which says, this stuff's not true. He thinks it's true, but he has like a screw loose. So he comes up with the wild and fascinating stuff. Yeah.
I would assume this week of Shlosh Regalim in one was probably the week before his baby's bris.
No. It's unclear if those two stories are connected at all. We're not sure. No, we don't know. In other words, the biggest mystery here, and when it's popularized, people like to popularize it with Chalev, because he certainly did that in other points in time. He would offer a sacrifice.
Where
eat the chalev himself. So I'm the Mizbeach. Okay? See, it's not clear if that's what he did over here or not. It's not clear if that's what he did over here, but this is the beginning of Shabtai Tzvi's, like, very wild, and the proper term, academic term for it is antinomian. That means, let's see how you try to say that in proper English. That was proper English. Antinomian means when you undermine religion for supposed spiritual. When you undermine religious structure, religious act, based on what you feel are hyper spiritual reasonings. That is antinomian. That's when they
talk about antinomian. That's what they mean. And this is when he starts this. And this is a very, this is, what's the right word? Important point in Shabtai Tzvi's life and career. And he does it, this is repetitive. And the first time it happened was 1658 in Constantinople. And they threw him out, they not only threw him out, they most likely put him in prison and gave him Malchus also. Jewish Bezin, yes. The Jewish Bate Dinim had a lot of power in Sephardi countries in those days. A lot of power.
Like what Lahab was saying, Islam today, sort of.
Yeah, correct. Okay, now, this is one of the places, this is the first place we're going to discuss it. We're going to discuss it again in 2 or 3 weeks. Was Shabtai Tzvi influenced by Christian theology? In other words, this concept of Mashiach, of the Mashiach gets new law, abrogates former law, is Matir Asurim. There's a certain...
No, it's very much like Paul.
Okay, very good. There's a certain, superficial similarity to Christianity, and that leads to the question...
But he never...
Was Shabtai Tzvi influenced by Christian theology or not? So...
That's a hard...
Yashka never had any fish babies.
What's the symbol? It's the fish symbol.
It's a hard... Okay. The problem's like this. The problem's like this. Now, there are those who think he was. There are Gretz and others who are sure he was, and they repeat it more than one time. There are people who think he was. It raises a big problem, though, because Shabtai Tzvi was a very, you know, from everything else we know about him, he's a limited traditionalist.
Yeah, he thinks like what he's doing, he thinks are in the parameters of his religion.
Okay, there you go. He doesn't, unlike, if Gershon Sholem totally rejects it, he totally rejects the Christian theoretical influence. He says there's no point in his life where he should have been exposed on any high level to Christian theology and thought. And it just makes it very unlikely that he actually picked any of it up. Again, we don't know. That gets us back. What languages did Shabtai Tzvi know? He knew Hebrew. He probably knew Arabic. He probably knew Ladino.
Greek.
He may have... We don't know. We have no proof that he knew Greek. That's a possibility, but it's not murach. We know he knew Ladino because he would sing Spanish songs. But he should know Ladino because he even if he himself is not Yotzei Svar, but he's living in a city which is dominated by Yotzei Svar, so he should know Ladino. Did he know Turkish? No. We know he did not know Turkish. If he didn't know Greek and Latin, then how is he supposed to have any real access to Christian theology? There's no proof he knew Greek and Latin. Hence, it seems unlikely. There's no point in his life where he seems to have met someone or read books, etc., which would give him deep exposure to Christian theology. Gershon Sholem rejects it completely. His main proofs are that, unlike Paul, Shabtai Tzvi wasn't telling his followers, you know, Torah's done. It was for him. Because he's Mashiach and he's going to do tikkunim. The way he does tikkunim is by doing yisurim. Okay, that was his wild thought. But he didn't say other people should do it. A and B is he only did these strange acts when he himself was manic. But when he was normal, he reverted to normalcy and kept Torah. As a matter of fact, even when he was manic and he did something wrong, even at the end of his life, He would, if his followers didn't say to him, Shabtai, why were you doing that? Not Shabtai, you know, Amira. Why didn't you do that? Why did you do that? Because it's against Shulchan Aruch. He would say, yeah, you guys forgot to catch me. I just did some tikkunim. So he to a certain extent, accepted,
He sort of meant well, but was never able to control it, sort of, and since he couldn't control it, it just led to...
The way it got wild, in other words, he himself is going, is having a manic progression of more wild and, you know, stranger and stronger acts. You know, what he did earlier, trying to stop the sun, you know, proclaiming a day is like Purim. Those are like small fry acts. Marrying a Sefer Torah is pretty strange. I mean, there's a couple of brachot levatalos involved, but celebrating Yom Tov in the wrong time, you know, that's like another step off. So there's certainly a progression here. But again, it's limited to him. He doesn't say other people should do it. It may be close followers. He gets close followers to do it, but it wasn't that everyone. This is not new law for everyone. And again, it's only done when he's manic. But when he's normal, he keeps Torah. And even when he's manic, he knows he's doing something wrong. He just thinks they're tikkunim. It's not like Christianity rejects. Christianity says Torah ad kan, new start. So Shabtai Tzvi doesn't do that. He's much more complicated than that. Fine, ad kan, guys. Call here.